From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. This Memorial Day, an extended nightline called The Fallen will be devoted entirely to reading the names and showing the photos of the 900-plus service members who died in Iraq and Afghanistan since last May. The same format, when it was aired last year, incited sharp criticism from the Sinclair Broadcast Group, who refused to air it on its 8 ABC affiliates. Sinclair complained that the show appeared, quote, to be motivated by a political agenda designed to undermine the efforts of the United States in Iraq. Not so this year. In fact, Sinclair has praised Nightline for bringing the names and faces of the dead to its viewers' attention.
The Fallen is now a yearly tribute, but what of the daily coverage of the dead and the wounded? Countless lives on both sides have been ended or reshaped by a war well into its third year, yet we rarely, if ever, see pictures of the casualties, especially American casualties. Recently, Los Angeles Times reporter James Rainey surveyed six major U.S. papers and two news magazines during a six-month period to find out how many pictures of American casualties had run in their pages. He found that while 559 Americans and their allies died during that period, only one picture of a fallen American soldier ran.
One picture in eight publications over 6 months really doesn't give you much of an accounting of the many people who were killed. I think there were about 570 U.S. soldiers and Marines killed during that time.
And how about pictures of Iraqi dead?
The Iraqi dead, there were quite a few more pictures. For instance, in our paper during that time, there were 22 photos of Iraqis killed. There were about 20 of Iraqis wounded. On the American side, there has been some effort to hold back or to censor photos. Often it's not outright censorship. It's holding the photos for what everybody agrees is a good reason, which is notification of family members. But if the photo gets 3 or 4 days or a week old, suddenly it's not newsworthy. It no longer makes the newspaper. So that is one factor. We did find that a large factor was just simply when you'll have an explosion, a roadside bomb, a sniper attack, and Americans are killed or wounded, often there's not a photographer anywhere in the area.
So there are logistics, but how do the soldiers in the field themselves feel about it when the embedded photographers who have been with them all along suddenly start shooting pictures of terrible events?
Well, the soldiers, I think it's a very difficult situation for them. I think they come to really respect the photographers. I mean, after all, these photographers are right there at the front. They're armed only with a camera. They're being shot at right along with the soldiers. But when a soldier or a Marine is killed, obviously there's a lot of sadness. And often what I found in my reporting happens is the soldiers kind of unite in common cause, and unfortunately for the journalists at that point, they become sort of the outsider, the other, and they often suffer consequences like one of our photographers did in Najaf. Carolyn Cole, last August, was trying to get pictures of some casualties who were brought back into a base there, along with Tyler Hicks, the New York Times photographer, and the soldiers simply have set up a kind of human shield, if you will, a blockade, and did prevent the two photographers from getting those pictures of, I think, at least two soldiers who'd been killed and several who were wounded.
But you also discovered that some photojournalists are choosing to withhold certain images on their own.
Yeah. One case that I wrote about was about Dean Hoffmeyer, who's a photographer from a newspaper in Virginia. He was embedded with a unit, and he was almost blown up himself when a suicide bomber hit the base. He pulled himself up, and the first thing he saw was this young soldier right next to him who was bleeding profusely from the neck. And people were trying to help the soldier, and Dean, by instinct, he started taking pictures. He later just felt that it was too personal, it was too intrusive, and that maybe the pictures were so bloody that his editors back here in the United States wouldn't be willing to run them. He told me, thinking about what would it have been like if his own son had been caught in a situation like that, how would he feel about seeing those photos? He put all that together and he just decided he wasn't going to send the photos. And in fact, he never showed them to his editor until he got back to the United States. In the United States, there's just been a tradition where editors here don't tend to show that. And that's something that's just been continued in this war, and maybe exacerbated even a little bit by concerns about appearing unpatriotic or unsupportive of the troops.
Do we even know for sure that if somebody views these pictures, these very sad and horrible pictures, that it will necessarily turn them against the war?
No, not necessarily. There was a survey done about one of the photos that we ran with our series, which was of a young soldier who was killed in Baghdad, a fellow named Travis Babbitt. The Associated Press managing editors did a survey of that and other graphic photos and actually found out of thousands of readers who they asked about this, something like 59-60% of the readers said, yes, you should run a picture like this. And one of the readers in particular said, you know, God bless this young man and his service to his country. That's what this picture tells me. This picture doesn't tell me we should leave Iraq. It tells me that the ultimate sacrifice is being made there by our troops. So, unfortunately, this debate sometimes gets divided up. Conservatives, liberals. Conservatives don't want the pictures. Liberals do. But what I found in reporting this story is that people need to see these pictures because they then have the information. They can process it in any way they want. And some of them are deciding, well, that's the price of trying to help the Iraqi people, and I'm willing to pay it. Other people see them, and they draw the opposite conclusion.
Jim, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
Jim Rainey is media writer for the Los Angeles Times.
Jim Lewis has always believed in photography. The journalist and novelist often writes about photography and has done quite a bit himself, most memorably at the scene of a horrific atrocity in 2003 in Congo. There was a time when he believed that graphic pictures were crucial for documenting the horrors of war, but no longer. We spoke to him last spring after he wrote an article in Slate about his change of heart. He explained why he believes pictures of violence, including those of the charred bodies strung up in Fallujah in 2004, did not necessarily help anyone understand the story.
Part of the problem with printing photographs like this is that they tend to strip away any of the context which would help anybody actually understand the story. You know, what did these guys look like before this happened? You know, what were they traveling in? What part of town were they in? How many people actually were there? All of that gets lost in the grisly sight of these bodies hanging from a bridge. I just think that to the extent that it's the function of journalism to explain things to people, photographs like this actually do less explaining than one might otherwise wish.
Your thinking on the subject changed based on your own work in Eastern Congo.
Mm-hmm.
You were there almost a year ago. Tell me about your experience.
Yeah, I was based in a little town called Bunia, and we went out of town one day, myself and another reporter and a photographer, up into the hills outside of town where we had heard that there had been a massacre, and we got there and there was, and there was nobody else there except for the people who had died, and they had been not just killed but dismembered and in a particularly horrific way. And after I had finished sort of taking my notes, and the people I was with had other work to do, and I didn't know what to do, and I was just kind of standing around and took out my camera and took a lot of photographs.
So what you had in your camera was something shocking, something extraordinary. At what point did you know that your mind had changed and that whatever these pictures were, they were not something to be shared with a mass audience?
I would be talking to friends and family and people that I worked with and trying to explain what was going on in the Congo and what I had seen, and I would show them these photographs along with others, and I just found that they got in the way of trying to tell the story I wanted to tell, and that, in fact, rather than clarifying the story, the shock of the photographs had a tendency to derail both my telling of the story and other people's understanding of it.
In your piece in Slate, you referred to a story where a man killed himself and that the suicide was captured by the security cameras in his building and then somehow found their way to an internet site that traded in shocking video footage and so forth. And the mother of the victim, I believe, was beside herself, wondering how her son's death could turn into a sort of pornography.
What I mean by pornography is just that the fact that such a thing exists on film at all is often so surprising to people, or so shocking or exciting or whatever it may be, that it tends to overwhelm the information that the pictures would otherwise actually convey.
Now, I saw the Fallujah pictures when they were first published and aired, and they were genuinely horrifying. But I must say, I was not as moved by them as I was by a single line in a single Wire story about one of the kidnappings in Iraq. It was of a Jerusalem resident who evidently also has a United States driver's license. And the kidnappers, to prove that they had this guy in custody, were showing his passport and his U.S. driver's license and his supermarket frequent shopper's card.
Mm-hmm.
And the very quotidian nature of a supermarket frequent shopper's card was so humanizing for me that I got very choked up, far more than I did from the most graphic pictures emerging from the war.
I have much the same sorts of reactions. I used to think that only a photograph can really accurately convey what goes on in a war, and that anything less than absolute explicitness would amount to a kind of whitewashing. And I think, in fact, that's simply not true. A well-written paragraph can be just as informative and just as horrifying and just as touching, but doesn't run the same kinds of risks.
Well, Jim, thank you very much.
Thank you.
We spoke to novelist and journalist Jim Lewis last year.
Coming up, the Christian Science Monitor is saving itself, and the Vatican extends its mandate to save the soul of soccer.
This is On the Media from NPR. This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. This week, President Bush and Afghanistan's President Hamid Karzai met at the White House to have their pictures taken together and stand in the East Room to take a few questions from the press. Both presidents were under the impression that several members of the Afghan press would be on hand.
Somebody from the Afghan press?
Anybody from the Afghan press? Do we have an Afghan press? Oh, here he is.
There was just one Afghan reporter present. According to NPR, 9 other Afghan reporters had intended to make the trip to Washington, but were detained in the end by their own government, who decided that the journalists could attempt to flee once inside the United States. Reportedly, according to an anonymous source quoted in the Washington Times, an image-conscious White House quickly packed the empty reporters' seats with interns. And not just the Afghan reporters, they also filled the seats of American reporters because most of them didn't show up either. Ron Hutchison is the White House correspondent for Knight Ridder and the president of the White House Correspondents Association. He joins me from his office in the Capitol to discuss empty chairs at the press availability. Ron, welcome to OTM.
Hi, Brooke.
So first of all, did you attend the briefing?
No, I did not. I was going to until I heard that it was going to be the usual two questions per side format. That is, two questions for the American press, two questions for the visiting press. And I decided not to go.
Was this the boycott that we've been hearing about? We have heard that the Washington Press Corps was talking about boycotting background briefings, but this one was on the record.
Yeah, this is a totally different issue. And in this case, what happens is you start to feel like a prop after a while, because it's clear that there's a protocol here, and the two questions are always going to go to the wire service reporters, first the Associated Press and then Reuters. So the rest of us are just kind of sitting there providing a backdrop. There's not much of a boycott in either case, to be honest with you.
Is that partly because the New York Times has declined to join it, or was it just a pipe dream?
That was just a pipe dream. In fact, Brooke, I tried it once, and it turned out to be a one-man walkout. I looked over my shoulder, and there was no one there. But I don't really fault my colleagues for that. I mean, the problem with that scenario is if one person stays, you lose some competitive advantage. The approach that we have taken is to just press the White House not to do it. And we've seen some improvement. There's been at least two cases I know where they initially said they would be on background, and after protest, they put them on the record. So we're not where we want to be, but we've seen some improvement in that regard.
I'd like to shift gears now a little and talk about a new study that came out this week from the University of Pennsylvania's Annenberg Public Policy Center.
Mm-hmm.
This study showed what most of us already knew, that journalists have a lot more faith and place a lot more importance on journalism than the non-journalists of the population do. When serious mistakes were made, 74% of the journalists said news organizations report quickly the error, but only 30% of the public thought so. 41% said they try to cover them up. There seems to be a problem here with the public perception of journalism.
That's an understatement, Brooke. And for those of us in the business, it's pretty depressing to see the public views toward the media. And, you know, sadly, a lot of these wounds are self-inflicted. There's been just, you know, more cases than I can name of journalists who have done things that are beyond the pale ethically, and all of us pay the price every time that happens. And it's compounded by the generally positive development of media watchdogs out there, programs like this, which helping to keep us all honest. But unfortunately, the process has exposed some glaring inadequacies that have really shaken confidence in the media.
I thought that the most interesting finding in the report, and tell me what you think, is that only 16% of the news professionals polled thought that it was a good thing if some news organizations had a decidedly political point of view in their coverage of the news, but 43% of the non-journalists thought it was okay.
We tend to view ourselves as professionals who leave our opinions at home, and the public just doesn't buy it. And you hear all the time, well, if you're going to have a bias, let's just be right up front about what it is. And, I mean, we're kind of seeing that with the popularity of Fox. And I think it's a real disturbing trend, because people increasingly tune in to news outlets that reinforce their opinions instead of challenge them.
Finally, I want to address something completely different that's come up a lot in our email, and that is the infamous Downing Street memo published this month in the London Sunday Times.
Right.
The memo from 2002 seems to show that the Bush administration had resolved to go to war in Iraq long before it had officially formulated its case based on weapons of mass destruction.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we've gotten a lot of complaints that this hasn't gotten traction in the U.S. press. Has it come up in the gaggle?
You know, what you've got is somebody who had a good source in British intelligence that I frankly don't have. In a situation like that, what you try to do is use information to pry out more information. Well, now I'm relying on somebody else's account of a source that I don't have, so it's really hard to use it as much of a club. Somebody in the White House press corps brought it up and got a non-responsive answer. You can keep asking and keep getting non-responsive answers, but we need to find a kind of a leverage point to break something out on that. I mean, I do think it's a story worth following up. It's just a difficult one in practical terms to follow up on. I can understand the frustration of some of the readers who've noticed this. And by the way, I've gotten quite a few emails myself.
Well, thank you for that.
Thank you.
Ron Hutchinson is Knight Ridder's Washington correspondent and the president of the White House Correspondents Association.
With the circulation that has plummeted in recent decades and costly broadcast ventures that broke the bank to the tune of $300 million, the Christian Science Monitor is at a turning point in its almost century-long history. Founded in Boston as an outreach of the First Church of Christ Scientist, the paper is more public service than house organ, still subsidized largely by the church, which has fallen on hard times. Recently, the paper announced editorial staff cuts, a renewed marketing push, and a new top editor, a longtime church member who is not a practicing journalist. Marshall Ingerson, on the other hand, is a journalist, a veteran at the Monitor for 25 years and current managing editor. Marshall, welcome to OTM.
Thanks.
The Monitor has always been sort of a strange beast, a paper with an absolutely sterling journalistic reputation, and yet has this connection with a church. Tell me about the relationship with the Christian Science Church and how it plays out editorially.
The paper was started by the founder of the church.
Mary Baker Eddy?
Mary Baker Eddy, right. And it was the heyday of the Hearst and Pulitzer empires and what we now call yellow journalism, which was very sensational. And Mrs. Eddy founded the paper with the fairly simple purpose, it's still written by our flag today, our masthead of the paper, to bless all mankind, translated to provide good, sound, quality information with a reader in mind who wants to be a good citizen of the world.
So the paper is explicitly a church outreach, but if it were called, for example, the Boston Monitor, would there be any way for a reader to divine that it was published by a church organization?
Probably the biggest difference is that the reader would wonder, how on earth can some publisher afford to do this? Because we do all the things that are most cost inefficient to do in journalism, foreign bureaus, national bureaus, a readership that's spread all over the country. And our staff is made up of a mix of church members and non-church members. I don't necessarily know who is and who isn't affiliated with the church. Everybody who works for the Monitor has in some way or another signed on to the mission of it. And generally, that's just doing what I think most journalists regard as good journalism.
Is there any kind of prior review of the contents of the paper from anyone in the church outside of the newspaper itself before publication?
The only prior review is on the editorial page itself, the staff editorials and the editorial cartoon. Those are seen as the voice of the paper, the opinion of the institution in some degree.
Now, you have a new editor, Richard Bergenheim.
Right.
I understand he has done away with the prior review policy.
I don't know that he's done away with it or that the directors have told him that they're going to suspend that for the time being, and he's got the only prior review of the editorials and the cartoon. That's been true for maybe a week now.
Richard Bergenheim is a longtime church member, but never has been a journalist, at least not one who has worked within the newsroom environment. So one way of looking at this is that the church is actually putting an extra layer of distance between it and the product. The other is that it has a mole inside the organization. What is the staff thinking at the moment?
The staff reception, I have to say, has been pretty good. From the beginning, he came into the newsroom and was deferential, you might say, about the news professionals on the staff. And he's very sophisticated about news. But, hey, don't believe me. I work for the man.
Well, noted. I am curious, though, whether there's any sentiment that the church, frustrated by losing millions of dollars a year, is getting impatient that it's not getting, I don't know, more bang for its buck.
They want to see some assurance that we're not just talking to ourselves, that we're providing enough value here that people are willing to pay for it. So I do think philosophically there is that desire that the paper be much closer to self-sufficiency.
Well, let's talk about that. In the category of a tree falls in the forest, your circulation at one point was something like 200,000, and now it is substantially dwindled. What are the numbers at the moment?
Around 60,000.
So if that beautiful little bonsai tree of yours falls in the forest and there's only 60,000 people there to notice it, does it make sufficient noise for the church to keep spending good money after bad?
One of the ironies of the time is that in many ways the impact of the Monitor is greater than it's ever been. We generally have at least 1.8 million visitors per month to our website. But the print is the part that brings in the money, and that's our problem. In a sense, we've got the same problem the whole newspaper industry has right now. It's just that it's got us at sort of a more critical spot because we aren't coming off of decades of very fat profit margins.
The Monitor has, in fact, had to close down its cable channel, had to close down Monitor Radio, and now once again, The newspaper itself is in a retrenchment. Do you have the sense that the staff is losing morale?
No, I don't think so. We've started an interesting conversation on the staff. What's the kind of journalism we want to do? What makes the most impact? You know, sitting in these meetings, it's very inspiring to me. But I don't want to be putting lipstick on a pig here. It is a retrenchment, and that's never fun.
All right. Well, Marshall, thank you very much.
Thank you, Bob.
Marshall Ingerson is managing editor of the Christian Science Monitor.
Sports commentary is a staple in most cities. Vatican City is no exception, where priests and even cardinals, so-called soccer missionaries, weigh in on the games. Now, Official Vatican Radio has started a new show where listeners can tune in weekly to hear the church's take on everything from doping in cycling to bad calls by soccer referees. While the show is a first for the Vatican, there's a long-standing link between church and soccer, as Megan Williams reports from Rome.
It's a typical Monday morning at Vatican Radio. After a papal news update, some musical spiritual inspiration, and then sports time. Non solo sport, not only sports, is the new weekly show on Vatican Radio's 105 Live. That's the FM station in Rome that hit the airwaves 4 years ago to give the Vatican a new, younger voice. But with the average age of priests somewhere in the 60s, youth is relative. Cardinal Fiorenzo Angelini is the regular commentator on Non Solo Sport. He's 88. Each week he phones in to give host Luca Colori his take on anything from doping and cycling to the presence of foreign players on Italy's club teams. The show has even caught the interest of the secular media, and the Italian state-run Rai Radio picked up Non Solo Sport after its first edition and rebroadcasts it nationally. This week, Cardinal Angelini is defending some questionable calls of a referee in a recent A-Series soccer match. He backs the ref, reminding listeners that everyone can make an honest mistake. Clerical soccer commentary is hardly new in Italy. For years, a nun who was a fan of the Rome team Lazio was a media sweetheart, and the Catholic daily The Roman Observer offers extensive sports coverage. For 20 years, Patty Agnew has covered sports for the Irish Times in Italy and says the church has never shied away from talking soccer.
I suppose it's simple enough, and a Catholic country, priests are going to be involved in things. You know, I come from Ireland, and there are a couple of priests in Ireland who are famous for being tipsters in relation to horse racing, because horse racing is the national sport in Ireland. So they've always had people connected to the church playing an important role in various cultural manifestations of Italian life. So why not in football?
Even John Paul II was widely known to have loved the game and played goaltender as a boy, and he was quietly rumored to have rooted for the Lazio team. Soccer historian Stefano Romita says the roots of the game in Italy were planted on the very fields of the Catholic Church.
Every boy grew up playing soccer after school on the church field. There was space to play, free breakfast, and other little treats in exchange for serving at the Mass.
By the 60s, every pro team had taken on a priest for spiritual guidance. Many of the players came from small towns and had trouble coping with the sudden fame and wealth. The priests tried to keep them on the straight and narrow. But the cozy relationship between the church and soccer didn't last, as commercial interests began to take over the game. The church's role in soccer dwindled. Starting in the 70s, so did the church's role in Italian life. Today, less than 30% of Italians believe the church should have a say anywhere beyond the chapel doors. Even fewer go to Mass. As Patty Agnew points out, Italy seems to have replaced one religion with another.
Well, sometimes I suspect that Italians are much more a la carte about their Catholicism than they are about their football. I mean, I think sometimes they take their football much more seriously than they do their Catholicism.
Which may explain why the Vatican is charging back into the world of sports. But that doesn't necessarily mean sports fans will want to listen to priests. Soccer historian Stefano Romita says he bristles at the idea of priests or nuns commentating on sports.
Remember, Italy is a very secular country, so Italians, for the most part, have not appreciated this intrusion of the church in public space.
But the Vatican says it's not just about appealing to a larger audience,
and getting a crack at bringing all those stray sheep back on the Christian team.
Internazionale, il fatto che la Radio Vaticana faccia parlare vescovi e cardinali.
Today, Vatican Radio sports host Luca Collodi tells listeners that the show's purpose is to underline the personal, spiritual, and physical values of sports.
Sport che poi è anche educazione della persona, dello spirito e del corpo.
Father Carlo Mazza, director of the Office for Sports and Leisure at the Vatican, would like to go even further. He wants the Vatican to tackle the unsavory aspects of the pro sports world as well, because, he says, he'd like nothing less than to save soccer.
Noi siamo in profonda comunicazione, in profonda anche responsabilità con I vertici.
We are in deep dialogue and responsibility with the heads of the soccer world, so that together we can work to change all the negative things in the sport, like doping, violence, and excessive commercialization. We all agree what the problems are. We now have to work together to resolve them.
In qualche modo nel togliere queste difficoltà.
For now, Mazza hopes Italians will begin to take heed of what the soccer missionaries have to say about sports, hoping one day Italians just might tune back into the church's broader message. For On the Media, I'm Megan Williams in Rome.
Coming up, the softer side of North Korea and why Mr. Smith should never have gone to Washington.
This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the Kresge Foundation, building the capacity of non-profit organizations through challenge grants since 1924, on the web at kresge.org. The Wallace Foundation, supporting ideas, sharing solutions, expanding opportunities, on the web at wallacefoundation.org. And the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, making grants to improve the health and healthcare of all Americans, on the web at rwjf.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Since its unsolicited selection for the Axis of Evil, North Korea has largely fulfilled its media role as America's Asian arch-nemesis. Isolated, repressive, erratic, and now nuclear. But there's at least one place where North Korea's image has been softening. South Korea. And according to Wall Street Journal reporter Gordon Fairclough, South Korean TV and film are the reasons why. He joins us now from Seoul. Gordon, welcome to the show.
Thanks very much, Bob.
Tell me about the images of North Korea on South Korean television before the 1999 Sunshine Policy went into effect.
There used to be quite a lot of government-sponsored propaganda about the North, and even in popular films and TV, some years ago there was a movie made about a North Korean plot to steal South Korean high explosives and detonate them in a soccer stadium. And the opening sequence of this movie shows North Korean commandos practicing bayonet drills on live people and actually killing people during their training. And there's this image of bloodthirsty and not quite human monsters there in the North.
That sounds harsh. What about in nonfiction, documentary and news coverage of the North?
The North and the South, for a long time, were locked in a kind of neck-and-neck struggle, economically, politically, militarily. And after the demise of the Soviet Union, North Korea's economy has really spiraled downwards. And so over the course of the 90s, instead of seeing images of the North Korean military and North Korean industry, we started to see pictures of starving North Korean children as famine hit North Korea in the mid-1990s, causing perhaps a million or more people to lose their lives.
So either bloodthirsty, brainwashed zealots or pitiful figures who have lost the ideological and economic war. What has changed in the last 5 years?
Just more humanization, I think. You know, in a recent movie, there are a couple of North Korean Marines who are out fishing, and they get accidentally blown ashore in South Korea, and they're desperate to get home, and they're sort of befuddled by technology in South Korea. They can't figure out how to work the phone card, and, you know, it turns out to be one of these heroes with heart of gold stories, and they befriend a young South Korean girl, and they rescue her from a bunch of South Korean hoodlums by outsmarting and outfighting them, which is a kind of portrayal of North Koreans that probably would have been against the law in the old days. In fact, the most popular TV show on Saturday night here in Seoul this past season is a quiz show pitting elementary school kids from North Korea against kids from the South.
But I understand that this is produced with some degree of subterfuge. There's not actually a competition afoot here, is there?
That's true. There is a bit of editing sleight of hand involved here, which does confuse some viewers, despite the show's disclaimers. Basically, what the producers of the show have done is taken footage that they've pulled off a satellite from a North Korean show that aired last year, and they've interspliced that with new footage shot here in the South. They've built a set that looks exactly like the one in North Korea, and they've brought in a bunch of South Korean kids. They've even redubbed the voice of the North Korean MC to make it seem like she's bantering with the South Korean host.
If you were a sociologist, or if you were a journalist, Gordon, and you were looking at the kids from the North and the kids from the South, what conclusions about those societies could you divine?
Well, you know, some of the things on the surface are very obvious. All the North Korean kids are wearing matching white shirts and dark trousers, and their red Young Pioneer kerchiefs knotted around their necks. When they're answering questions, they tend to stand at attention behind their desks. The South Korean kids, on the other hand, you know, are decked out in multi-hued brand name clothing, and some of them are sporting hairdos spiked up with gel, and, you know, they laugh a lot. And interestingly, from some older South Koreans, they've made the point to me that, you know, those North Koreans, they behave better. They're more polite. They act more like good Korean kids should.
Is there any evidence that the sun is shining on the other side of the border? Have the images of the South, as far as you know, been softened by the media or any other institution in North Korea?
I think that there has been some toning down of rhetoric in the North. They used to hurl insults at each other over loudspeakers across the DMZ. That has stopped. But there is not the kind of general thaw that you see in South Korea.
Well, apart from the thousands of missiles on the north side of the DMZ aimed right at Seoul, what other reasons have Koreans in the South to wish for some sort of reunification?
I think actually South Koreans are rather wary about reunification right now. You know, a lot of South Koreans have looked at the case of the unification of Germany and decided that maybe South Korea is not quite ready yet to shoulder that burden. The gap between South Korea and North Korea is much bigger. And so what we're seeing here is a move towards a kind of peaceful coexistence, if you will, and an effort by the South to engage with the North and to try to guide it into some kind of a soft landing. Basically, they're hoping to create a kinder, gentler North Korea with which it could more easily reunify at some point in the future.
Well, Gordon, thank you very much.
My pleasure, Bob.
Gordon Fairclough is a staff reporter for the Wall Street Journal. We spoke to him in Seoul, South Korea. The blockosphere's impact on politics and culture is trumpeted everywhere these days, especially in the blogosphere. But how much influence do bloggers really have? That question was addressed in a study released last week by the Pew Internet and American Life Project and Buzzmetrics, a market research company specializing in Internet chatter. The study looked at the last 2 months of the presidential election season and found that when it came to the main issues dominating the campaign, bloggers were followers as often as they were agenda setters. But some bloggers and Internet surfers do greatly influence other aspects of life in America. At least, that's what many members of the food, pharmaceutical, and technology industries think. In recent years, they've hired Buzzmetrics to find out who exactly these trend-setting influencers are. Buzzmetrics president and CEO Jonathan Carson says it's like finding needles in the hay of tens of thousands of public chat rooms, blogs, and email listservs.
What we do is we look first at the individuals that talk most frequently, but that's not the only characteristic because sometimes you get people that talk a lot with nobody listening. So we also look at their ability to start robust conversations. What's the word count of the conversations that ensue? And in the blogosphere, we look for characteristics like the number of individuals linking to that blogger or the number of individuals that cite them within their own blogs.
Okay, so tell me, please, some of the insights that you've divined from tracking these people.
For the food industry, we found 500 consumers that we feel are most influential for nutrition trends. This has been important for the food industry because in the past several years, they've missed out on many big grassroots trends. Low carb is the big obvious example. And what happened there is the scientists said it's junk science, it's a fad, just ignore it. Meanwhile, consumers were going into their offices, looking into the cubicle next to them, seeing their colleagues eating a pound of bacon every morning and losing all this weight. So low carb became this grassroots trend that defied what the scientists believed would happen. That turned into a multi-billion dollar mistake for these food companies because they weren't tapping into the pulse of the consumers. We believe that we've created the bridge by which to study these grassroots movements.
Now, Jonathan, as you know, there is another sort of influencer business, and that is people recruited and planted in bars and online to seed public opinion on behalf of marketers. How do you know that your influencers aren't actually shills?
Well, we have various tools within our database to kind of ferret that out. The kind of easiest tool that we have is based on an instinct of human laziness. When companies are hired to masquerade as consumers in these deceptive marketing practices, they tend to use the copy and paste function frequently. And so we're able to identify those duplicative messages within our database.
And I got to ask you this. On our show a few weeks ago, we had some stories about soldier bloggers in Iraq who are sharing with the world at large their experiences in the military with varying degrees of interference from the command chain. Now, I understand that you had inquiries from the Defense Department to keep track of what the soldier blogosphere is up to. Can you tell me about that?
We've had various conversations with individuals in the government, and I think that the military faces a unique circumstance where the so-called trade secrets or insider information has life and death ramifications. So rightfully so, they're looking at the dissemination of information very cautiously. At the same time, I think the military has an intuitive appreciation for the fact that they can avoid the charges of kind of propaganda that they typically have to deal with in their communications by allowing soldiers to talk with that human voice.
I can foresee a situation where a client of yours is told what I'm saying on a subject that could affect his business. And instead of changing his product line, he decides instead to shut me up or to shut me down. Has that happened yet? And have you taken any steps to keep clients from trying to shoot the messenger?
We certainly counsel our clients that that is not the way to market within this new world. And it's been demonstrated in numerous case studies that if you go in with a heavy hand and try and shut up your opposition, there will be backlash. Apple Computer is kind of going through it right now. It's suing a number of bloggers for releasing trade secrets or insider information about the company's new products. There's been a huge backlash amongst a community that has always been very pro-Apple. And so I think that marketers are learning their lesson very quickly that that's not the way to behave within this new world.
All right. Well, Jonathan, thanks so much.
Thank you, Bob.
Jonathan Carson is president and CEO of Buzzmetrics.
Monday, Senate Republicans led by Majority Leader Bill Frist agreed not to abolish the filibuster, for the moment, if the Democrats agreed not to use it against some judicial nominees. But John Bolton isn't a judicial nominee. He's the president's pick for U.N. ambassador. So on Thursday, when he came up for a vote, Democrats stalled it with a filibuster. Now, until the recent controversy, the filibuster was just an arcane Senate maneuver. True, Huey Long and Strom Thurmond used it to make history, but it took a senator named Jefferson Smith to make Hollywood magic.
Senator Smith has now talked for 23 hours and 16 minutes. It is the most unusual and spectacular thing in the Senate annals. One lone and simple American holding the greatest floor in the land.
Tim Noah, who writes the Chatterbox column for Slate, is the rare liberal who would be glad to see the end of the filibuster. But when he tries to make his case, he finds he runs smack up against Frank Capra's Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, 66 years old and still an immovable object.
Well, it's a great argument stopper. You're arguing that the filibuster ought to be done away with. You're citing the terrible uses it was put to block civil rights legislation. And someone will say, what about Mr. Smith Goes to Washington? And, of course, the first part of the answer is, well, Mr. Smith Goes to Washington is a movie. It's not real life.
I've got a few things I want to say to this body. I tried to say them once before, and I got stopped colder than a mackerel. Well, I'd like to get them said this time, sir. And as a matter of fact, I'm not going to leave this body until I do get them said.
Essentially, in the film, Mr. Smith was being silenced by his colleagues. In fact, he was going to be censured and tossed out of the Senate, and he took recourse in the filibuster. It was the only way he could get people to hear what he had to say. You say even that's a fallacy.
Yes. Well, we get this false notion from Mr. Smith that filibusters today are all about giving speeches where you're making your case. And that hasn't been the routine anyway for quite some time. Today, when the Senate leadership learns that the other side is planning a filibuster against a bill, they don't try and press it and have the speechifying occur. They skip it and go on to the next bill.
What we know about Mr. Smith is he's a little guy. He's not part of anybody's machine. Could a minority of one, like Mr. Smith, actually have an impact using the filibuster?
Today, there is a cloture requirement. If you have 60 votes, you can stop a filibuster. That actually wasn't true before World War I. In the grand old deliberative days, if one person had an objection to a bill, even if the other 99 people were in favor of the bill, they had to sit and listen to the speech. But that was changed after World War I.
So are you saying then that in 1939, when Mr. Smith was produced, the Senate could have called cloture on him right then and there?
Maybe they didn't have the votes. I don't know why they didn't call cloture, but it's a good point.
They walked out on him, all of them.
I'm sick and tired of this contemptible young man, and I refuse to stay here and listen to him any longer. I hope every member of this body feels as I do.
Get up! Get up!
I was really interested in your column when you noted that when the film premiered in 1939 at Washington's DAR Constitution Hall, it got an overwhelmingly hostile reception.
Yes, it's fascinating because the movie is a great sacred cow today. In fact, I joked in my column that what really brought about the compromise in the filibuster was the threat by both Democrats and Republicans to screen the movie in the Capitol. But very different reception back in 1939. The premiere was in Washington, and Capra wrote in his autobiography that about a third of the audience walked out on the film. He was called a villainous Hollywood traducer, he writes. And he talks about an interview that the Christian Science Monitor had with Alban Barkley, who was the Senate Majority Leader. And they were supposed to be talking about the debate over entering World War II. But Barkley changed the topic to Mr. Smith Goes to Washington and wanted to fulminate endlessly about it. He said it was as grotesque as anything I have ever seen. What interested me about Barclay's comments, retrospectively, is how in 1939, if you were a Senate Majority Leader and you saw a movie like this, your natural inclination was to identify with the body as a whole, the Senate. Today, of course, it would never occur to a senator, even a Senate Majority Leader, I think, to identify with anyone other than the rebellious Mr. Smith. And that tells you a lot about how our politics have changed.
I think it's pretty interesting when you talk about identification with Mr. Smith, that he was a scout leader, that character. And in the midst of this filibuster fight, Senator Frist actually was offering legislation to protect his Boy Ranger scouts.
I didn't know that. That sounds to me like a very conscious attempt to summon the spirit of the movie.
Tim, thank you very much.
Thanks a lot, Brooke.
Timothy Noah writes the Chatterbox column for Slate.
But those tired Boy Ranger legs are buckling, bleary-eyed, voice gone. He can't go on much longer, and all official Washington is here to be in on the kill.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Megan Ryan, Tony Field, Jamie York, and Mike Volo, and edited by Brooke. Dylan Keith is our technical director, and Jennifer Munson, our engineer. We had help from Nick Gilowitz. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer, and John Keefe, our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. This is On the Media from WNYC. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. The Kauffman Foundation of Kansas City, the foundation of entrepreneurship, on the web at kauffman.org, and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation. Support from the media comes from Hofstra University, which this November analyzes Bill Clinton's administration at the 11th of its presidential conferences. More details at hofstra.edu. And the Bidell Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the John and Anna Maria Phillips Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.